Hey y'all, I'm Ashley Renee.
Hi, I'm Jalian.
Hey everyone, I'm Lauren.
And we are the new team at
We Live Here.
As the new We Live Here team, we wanted to give you an opportunity to get to know us.
Exactly. I'm a journalist with a background in print who is excited to get into audio storytelling as co-host and producer of this show.
And I'm a recent Mizzou grad with a degree in broadcast journalism. I'm the associate producer.
After earning a Master of Social Work and Master of Divinity, I started creating podcasts on my own. And I'm looking forward to being the other co-host and producer of We Live Here.
Ja, you might have to put your Master of Divinity to work, just in case our listeners are having a hard time. They need you to console them.
Right, they might miss the previous co-host.
Or they might worry about the future of the show.
All right, well, if you're a longtime listener of the show, I want to acknowledge that this may be a difficult time. Change is hard. The previous co-hosts are no longer with us.
But, Ja, I mean, we saw each other in the break room like 5 minutes ago.
No,
the story about your cat.
Yeah, I know. Just, it's okay.
So you're saying I should just go?
Yes, just
go.
It's fine.
Okay.
We've got it. Bye. And you all may be experiencing some feelings of loss.
I just want to just jump in one more time.
And listeners, you might even want to pay money to throw some axes at a wall.
Do people do that?
Yes. Yes, they do. And no matter how you're feeling, I wanted to affirm that those feelings are completely valid.
But seriously, we know this is a big change.
Since our show focuses on race and class, we thought it would be a great idea to have a real conversation of our own personal experiences dealing with those same issues.
Yep. Three new team members with unique but similar stories.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, you're listening to We Live Here,
a podcast for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Ashley, we're going to talk about when we were first made aware of race and class, which is kind of a very both heavy question, but also something that is significant in our lives.
Oh, absolutely. I think race and class, if you are alive, you have experienced it one way or another. And so it's a conversation that, you know, it needs to be had. Absolutely.
And we were also talking about how, like, you can have similar backgrounds, like, in terms of where you come from, but also have a completely different experience about when that actually kicks in. So, Lauren, do you want to talk about where it kicked in for you?
Well, I would say I first became aware of race when I first started going to school. So, let's say around kindergarten. I knew all of my peers were African-American, just like I was, but most of the teachers were white or Caucasian. I don't know what to rather say. All the teachers were white, or some of the administrators, you know, principals and things like that. I had a couple black teachers, but not that many. And so I think that's when I first became aware of race. And then class, I grew up knowing that I wasn't rich, but I wasn't poor, and I knew I was somewhere in the middle. And I think the town that I lived in, which is a small kind of suburb about 20 minutes from downtown Chicago, it was a mostly mixture neighborhood, but a lot of the other races were like older families, like older white families, but most of the kids were all like black families. So growing up, I was able to, you know, walk around, ride bikes, do stuff like that until I got older. And now going back, I can tell the changes within that neighborhood. It's not as, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not as robust as it used to be. And so now it's kind of different. A lot of things are boarded up. A lot of things are torn down. They're trying to build something, then it doesn't last long. It's a lot more families moving there, and it's not as safe to do the same things that I used to do growing up. So I think that's kind of what's been going on. And my first actual, like, racial incident, I would say, when I was 15, my first job was at McDonald's. But I worked at a McDonald's in a different neighborhood that was kind of close to mine, but it was a mostly white neighborhood. So all the customers were white. Most of the people that worked there were white, except for a handful. And I remember this one time I was working in the drive-thru, and an older white lady came, and I said, "Hello, ma'am, your price is whatever, whatever." And she didn't want to give me her money. She didn't want to have to touch my hands.
Wow.
And so I was taken aback from it, but I didn't, it still didn't click with me right then and there. It didn't click. I was just like, okay, well, so I just asked somebody else to come and do it for me.
Please take her money for me.
And then I went on to the next person. And I think working at that job is when I started really noticing the differences in races and the differences in how people feel about you according to your race. Just whenever I was the one that they had to speak to, it was just a different vibe, a different tone. And so I think that was one of the very first things that I experienced in regards to race. And then after that, I think the next thing that really was a culture shock for me was attending the University of Missouri. That was a big culture shock. Like I said before, I went to school with mostly black kids, and so I had never been around that many races at one time. And even the town is very different from my town, and so it was very different. And that was fall of 2015. That was my freshman year, and as you all know, Mizzou had a protest during that year. So that was my freshman year of college, my first time being away from home. I never moved to a new house. I lived in the same house from the time I was born to right now at this moment. So I never moved anywhere or known any other place. And so this was my first time being away, and that's about 6 hours from home. And so it was just a culture shock. I mean, it was protests every day. People were camping out in tents. Someone was on a hunger strike. The football team got involved. And it was just so much. I remember just being on the Quran Quad, which is where they were having a hunger strike with the tents and everything, and bringing paper towels and bringing water and things. And you can see all the emotion in people's faces. And I don't think nothing happened to me directly. A lot of people said that they were walking around campus, they were getting called the N-word, and, you know, a lot of things were happening. But the only thing that happened to me personally in my dorm, it was a group of white males that used to harass us all the time. They would knock on our doors, run off, spit out food in front of the door, throw boxes and trash in front of the door. And so it was just so much. And I was like, I think I want to go home.
No kidding.
Right? I was like, I think I want to go home. Yeah. But I was like, this is a top journalism school. Yep. It was my first time away from home. I had cousins that went there and cousins that were still there. And so I was like, you know what? It's okay. It's fine. Everything is fine. I still have my friends. They had a Black Culture Center. They had other groups and things. And so it was just one day, the last day, they threw some trash in front of our door. And I was like, okay, I'm getting up out this bed and I'm going to say something. So
wow. That
opened
took a
the
lot
door.
Of guts.
I know. I opened the door and I was like, hey, why do y'all keep throwing trash and keep harassing us and keep knocking on the door? And so they were laughing and giggling and heckling, and they started running. So me, I started chasing them.
Yes.
When I tell y'all, we lived on the second floor, I chased them all the way to the fifth floor. I was chasing them, and it was just so much. I was chasing them, and they ran into their rooms, closed the door. I was outside there hitting the door, kicking the door. I was so upset. And so they never came out. So I'm like, okay, so my friends grabbed me. They was like, Lauren, you need to calm down. So we talked to the RAs and all of that, and we had meetings with, like, residential life and stuff. And they just had conversations with us. Nothing happened. They just had conversations, and we went to the Title IX office. I wrote down everything that happened from the first day I got there to that moment. I wrote it all down to give them, you know, a synopsis of what happened, and nothing happened. And I was working at the restaurant downstairs in that dorm, and they worked there as well. And so finally I was like, I quit this job. I'm not going to work there no more. Because I was just like, if I stay here, I know it's going to be a problem.
It's going to be over.
Right. And so that was like something that was really big, and just seeing the protests. And I was out there when Tim Wolf resigned, and it was so many different channels, news stations from across the country, just all there. And everybody was so excited, and then it just turned into too much. It was just too much. I feel like it was a big time for the school, and there was a lot of changes that needed to be made, and I don't know if those changes actually were made to this day. But after that year, it was just, I knew that it was a difference between me and the next person. I really knew, because the Black Culture Center during Black History Month, they threw cotton on the ground. Just so much. I was like, where am I at? I'm like, I know the differences. Even at home, I know the differences, and I know it's people in the world that don't look like me, that don't, you know, that don't feel a certain, that feel a certain kind of way about me, but it's not as in your face. I feel like here it's in your face. It's right there. You see it. You feel it. You can almost smell it. I feel like it's so thick.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. That was just, I feel like I've been rambling, saying so many stories, and I've just been talking about so many things. But just in St. Louis, I think after leaving Columbia, after going to Mizzou, and then being in St. Louis, I remember I went to interview the mayor of Webster Groves, and she asked me, in a couple months or a year, come back and talk to me. I want to see how you feel about the differences between racial tensions and racial divides in St. Louis and Chicago. And I was like, you don't have to wait 3 months or a year. Mm-hmm. I feel it now.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to wait. I feel it right now.
Right.
When I walk around, I was just walking around one day, and I was just by myself because I didn't know anybody here. So I was just walking around downtown, and I was supposed to go and ask people, you know, how they feel about the merger stuff and whatever. And a lot of people did not want to talk to me. And I don't know if it could be the microphone, it could have been that, but it was just, I just felt a difference. I just could tell, I felt it. I knew it was something different. I knew I was in a new place. And I was just like, wow, this is really deep.
Mm-hmm.
And the strangest thing is I want to know more about it, which is crazy.
Right.
And I think We Live Here is so important. And I can't wait to see what we can do with this show, because, like we said before, We Live Here should be not just in St. Louis, but in other cities, because you live there. You matter. We all matter. And I know I always say that, but it's like, it's true. This is important to all cities, all places, because a lot of people feel like their voices aren't heard. They feel like it's a lot of things going on and nobody's trying to make change. Nobody's talking about it. Nobody's asking the hard questions. Nobody's holding people accountable. And I think it's very, very, very important. So I don't know about you guys. That was a heavy story.
No,
good.
I think they should feel as lucky as we feel to have you on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And something that strikes me with that, one of the stories that you told us, is that you bring all of these journalist chops. You bring all of this curiosity and this very kind of honest approach and willingness to hear, okay, let me get to the bottom of this. Let me really understand. But all someone can see of you, if they have kind of their filters on, is your race, how you look, and that can completely shut them down.
That's
so,
true.
Yeah,
exactly. Even gender. Or,
it's true. Exactly. Yes.
Of course.
Exactly.
I don't know correct terms.
Misogynoir.
Yes, just
gender and class.
Yeah. Being
and
a woman and being Black,
mm-hmm.
and class, I feel like class is a part of that as well. But the first things I notice when I go into a room, I'm the only woman here. I'm the only Black person here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I don't think people really know how that feels.
How mm-hmm. isolating it
yes.
can feel. It is.
It's just.
You feel alone. I am born and raised in St. Louis. My mom always wanted us to have the best. Me and my sister, even my cousin, she always, you know, put this idea in our head that she wants us to go further than, you know, what she accomplished and what she did. And my family is like that. And so living in the city of St. Louis, at that time, city schools were just not performing as well as compared to more affluent school districts. So my mom put me and my sister in the DSEG program. And what that is that they take the kids that live in the city and bus them to West County and South County. And some of those kids were in districts like Ladue, Clayton, Kirkwood, Webster Groves, Lindbergh. And me and my sister were in Lindbergh School District. And so being in the kindergarten, I was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning so that I can get on the bus, take an hour or so bus ride to South County. And so imagine all of these little black kids who either live on the north side or the south side on this bus being, you know, basically taken out of our community, everything that we know, everything that we're used to, and being put in this predominantly white school system. And we were oftentimes either the only black kid in class or one other black kid. So I can say that race impacted me at a very young age, because I remember, like it was yesterday, anytime there was, you know, any group activities and one of my black friends weren't at school or in the classroom, I was always last to be picked. Nobody wanted to work with me because I was black. It was obvious. It was completely obvious that I was going to be picked to be last for the group, or picked to be last on one of the kickball teams or whatever. I just knew. And it wasn't like anything that my mom had a conversation with me like, you know, even though you're going to this school, just know that, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. We never had that conversation. So when I came home and I explained to her that my first grade teacher, Miss Million, I came home and I said, Mama, Miss Million treats the little black kids different from all the other white kids. And she said, well, how do you know? She had never had that race conversation with me before, but I noticed it. I noticed her tone. I noticed if I raised my hand and asked her for help, how she just felt disgusted. She literally did not want to help me. She didn't want to help any of the other black kids. Like, she just felt like we were bothering her, like we were taking up space. And right then I knew, okay, I know I don't look like these other kids. So there has to be a reason why she's treating me like this. I'm a girl. She didn't treat the little girl next to me like this. So I knew right then that she treated me like this because I'm black. It was just obvious. So with this show, I really hope that our listeners, not just in St. Louis, but other cities, can really grasp how race is trauma. Mm-hmm. It's not just an experience, mm-hmm. but it's trauma. And it can cause all sorts of mental breakdowns, and it can create barriers. And so I really, really hope that the stories that we tell, the solutions, the experts that we talk to, the real people about certain situations that affect them because of race and class, can understand that racial inequities cause trauma. Class inequities cause trauma. Gender inequities, it causes trauma. These are things that you can carry on with you throughout life and potentially pass down to your kids and generations after. I don't ever want to put fear into my future kids of white people. I don't want to have to teach them that, you know what, you're going to have to try twice mm-hmm. as hard, that you're automatically going to be judged, or you don't want to really drive in that neighborhood because they're going to pull you over. You know, I don't want to have those conversations with them, but because of my experiences and the fact that it's 2019 and we are still going through this, that conversation may still be in place. And so I hope that We Live Here pushes that needle forward where we don't have to have those conversations again.
And when you were talking about education, that just makes me think of zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Like I told you before, the neighborhood where I actually worked at the McDonald's, the high school in that neighborhood is actually closer to my house. I can literally walk to it. But I went to a different high school because of zoning. And so the school had came into a couple of money problems, and they said, well, we can keep the school open if we open up the zoning boundaries and allow these kids to come there. You know, they didn't mm-hmm. want to allow us to go there. Wow. So the school ended up closing.
Wow.
You didn't want us to go there. That's that bad shame. That you ended up closing the school. And it That's was brand new. It hadn't even been there that many years. It's brand new with a pool, everything. My high school didn't have a pool. We didn't have a swim team. They had all types of different sports, lacrosse. We didn't have mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow.
Wow.
They really don't want
that
us
is
to
really
go to
shameful.
This school. And even in college, just sitting there being the only black person in the class, it makes you feel like you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Or just feeling like, okay, I don't want to say anything because people always look to me like, oh, I hope she doesn't go crazy. Mm-hmm. And if the conversation is about slavery or other history, oh, well, how do you oh, feel yeah. about it?
Turn to you.
Well, mm-hmm. I feel a certain kind of way, but you yeah. don't want me to start preaching.
Are you ready?
Right, yeah. that's what I'm saying. Right. And mm-hmm. so then you get this stigma, this stereotype that because you're a Black woman, you're going to be loud, angry. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, if I feel a certain kind of way, regardless if I'm Black, white, Asian, Chinese, anything, if you feel a certain kind of way about something, you're passionate, it's going to show through your voice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Jai, you've been very quiet.
I've been listening.
Jump in yes. and tell us how race and class or even gender biases, you know, I've been through certain things where I was like, okay, yeah, he did that because I'm a woman. Had mm-hmm. I been a man, he would have never crossed me like mm-hmm. that.
Ooh, so I'm really glad you brought up education because I think that's where a lot of the story starts for me, and it's a thread that goes throughout. I think the question about how I was first made aware of race and class is a little difficult for me to answer because of course I have few memories of where, you know, me, my mom, and my sister might be walking down the street and there'd be like a car full of like white kids who are like ching ching chong ching chong, and the funniest thing about that is I grew up in a very Asian American community. I was in Silicon Valley, a lot of engineers, a lot of people who came here to work in the tech industries, and that's made possible by the Immigration Act of 1965. And so even though it was a majority Asian American suburb, there'd still be those comments. And when I was a kid, I internalized those interpersonal interactions to just people not knowing better. Mm-hmm. So growing up, a lot of my understanding of racism was people not knowing better and then also not knowing history. So it felt very distant to me. And at the same time, I think colorism plays a role in things. I think the way you appear also plays a role because my sister, she's just slightly more dark than I am. And her eyes are just slightly smaller. And she was picked on, bullied by a kid in her class. And he was a white boy. And it was just funny. You know, there's so many Asian kids in our elementary school, our middle school, our high school. But in elementary school, he just made fun of her eyes, was like, you know, can you even see out of those things?
Oh my.
But I didn't have this experience because I look different.
Mm.
And so I think that just taught me, learning about that in adulthood when she told me that story, it just taught me that racism personally, interpersonally, can show up even when someone is the minority, even when, you know, someone who benefits from white privilege is the minority, which is powerful.
Ooh, that is.
It's a trip.
Try to say that again for the people in the background.
Right. So racism can show up even when someone who benefits from white supremacy, white privilege, is a minority.
Wow.
Yeah. You
said something very profound. Yes. And
that's normal to me. I'm like, what is that?
And even I never thought of colorism in other
races
and ethnicity.
Yeah. I always thought it was a Black thing.
Yes.
I always thought colorism was a Black
thing. It's everywhere.
And that's amazing to me because it doesn't matter what race you are, darker seems
wrong.
Yes. Darker always seems wrong.
Bad. It's wrong. It's bad. It's an easy target. But I just want to touch on when you said being a minority but having the benefits of white supremacy and white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
That is powerful because that just shows how backwards our society is and how much work still needs to be done. That you can be a minority in a particular setting but have this sense of power.
Yes.
And control and even narcissism to a certain extent that you can bully someone else and feel you can get away with it and there's nothing wrong with it when you are outnumbered.
Right.
That's that privilege, y'all. That's that privilege.
I feel like when I was growing up, the thing that I did kind of start to understand around how society stacks things against people is around class. So like I said, a lot of people, their parents maybe were engineers, so was my dad at a time, but there were times where he'd get laid off or maybe let go from a job, and things became difficult in our household around finances. And at the same time, I really credit my mother for insulating us. We had hand-me-down clothes, but it was always a very like exciting thing. We get a whole bag from a friend, and then I got to try all things on, and you know, she'd tailor them so that they'd be just right. But at the same time, I think about the immigrant experience for some people and for me, where, you know, to answer the door when people were canvassing, or to pick up the phone when there were telemarketers, or to go to the doctor's office, sometimes me and my sister would need to translate for my mom, even though we were kids. And so I think that kind of wakes you up to kind of being a little bit of an adult early on. Mm. And I remember when I was applying for college, I really had to work really hard to work with my financial aid advisor to write letters of appeal being like, you know, we have to live in our house. That doesn't represent the income that we actually have. I need a little bit more assistance here. So it wasn't really until I got to St. Louis, kind of similar to you, Lauren, where I was hit with how race really works in America, and specifically the experiences of Black folks. So again, going back to why this question about how does race and class impact me, the reason why I feel like it's so difficult for me to answer is because I feel like my experience as an Asian American, as a lighter-skinned Asian American, as an East Asian, is there is this kind of invisibility where people don't see who you are. And in a city like St. Louis, I feel like things are so black and white. And I've had times where, for example, I might be involved in a protest in a pretty prominent role, and no one will know who I am. I could be dropping a banner and the news media will not do anything because they're so used to the black and white binaries, like black people versus white people. So what happens when you break that up with solidarity? So when the Ferguson uprising was happening, that was something that I was really concerned about. You know, how are Asians standing up for black folks? How are Palestinians getting involved? How are Latinx people getting involved? And at the same time, the reason why I came to St. Louis from California was to study social work and divinity. I was here getting my graduate degrees. And there were a lot of misconceptions that I had to quickly correct, a lot of labor that my friends did to help me understand things better. But I'm always still, even in this work with We Live Here, balancing my kind of research studying brain and also my human side, where I'm like, I need to be friends with people. I need to be involved in the community in a very authentic way that's not exploitive, that's not getting other people to work so hard to correct me, to help me to understand, but also to offer a benefit to their lives, to somehow make their lives easier, or at least show up for them, to walk alongside them.
That's interesting. And this is, I'm glad that you pointed out how St. Louis is very black and white, because we tend to be at times. When race issues come up, it's always black and white. You rarely hear other races like Asians or people who identify as Hispanic or anything like that. So, and is that the correct term, Hispanic?
It depends on what you're talking about, but yeah, so Latinx people, but also indigenous folks, I think, get let out of the conversation.
Completely.
You know, we think, even though Cahokia Mounds, one of the most significant civilizations in the past, was right here in this region, we don't talk about the people who made those mounds. And even today, you see these battles over sacred sites and who gets to decide what happens to the land, who gets to choose whether it's something that's sacred that can be passed on for generations, or who gets to put a pipeline through it.
Now, land. Land is something that can either bring everyone together or create a division. And in St. Louis, and I didn't Well, I've always realized it, but it really didn't hit home to me until I came back home from going to school in Chicago. And in Chicago, that was culture shock for me because it's super diverse. And communities are like literally a melting pot from my experience. And so when I would come home to St. Louis, you know, Christmas break, spring break, summer, or whatever, I realized that in my old neighborhood in North St. Louis was super cut off. You know, it was this pocket in the city that just basically got ignored. And it's predominantly Black. You know, you have some whites in that area sprinkled, and I would say most of them live east of Salisbury. But South St. Louis is that melting pot like Chicago. You know, and so it makes me wonder the mastermind behind destruction and housing projects, that if you clump everyone of the same race in one pocket without needed resources, survival will take over. And I think you will see an influx in crime. You will see an influx in high school dropout rates. You will see an influx in food deserts, because the need of survival is just bypasses a lot of things. So I think land plays a part in racism and where you place people. Thoughts?
I agree with that. Like you were saying, a lot of people, when they think of St. Louis or Chicago or any city, they think of all the monuments in the downtown area where a lot of tourists go, but it's so much deeper than that. Like you were saying, small towns, even like Inglewood in Chicago, like you have to think about these places that don't get any attention and nobody's trying to help or build anything or put any after school programs and gyms and more things for kids to have things to do. If they have nothing to do, no money, nowhere to go, what are you going to do? You have to find ways to get money. You have to mm-hmm. find ways to survive. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, it's all this crime and it's all these other things. But it's like,
well,
they don't have any food. They don't have anywhere to stay. They mm-hmm. don't have any resources, anybody to help them with job applications, mm-hmm. computers, internet. Mm-hmm. All of those things are a factor into the issues that we see in mm-hmm. these neighborhoods. And it's like, why am I able to go 5 miles this way and they have all of this, but when you come to my neighborhood they don't? And it's a very deep conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very deep conversation, and I don't think I started thinking so deeply about things like this until I got to college and started seeing different parts of the country, different parts of the world, and just learning that it's a lot of places similar to where I'm at, and people don't talk about it, and people don't know, it's just these conversations that we're having and what you were saying and what you were saying, and it almost makes me want to cry right now. It makes me want to cry. Like, I can't do anything about this. Like, I can. We're doing that right now. We're using our voices and we're using our platform and we're shining the light on people that need to have a light shine on them, that are doing good things, that are doing good work and trying to make, you know, this world a better place, and holding people accountable and trying to make sure that these changes are actually made, and that people who say something, they mean it and they actually do it.
Right.
You have to mean what you say, and you have to keep trying and keep trying. My dad always told me, whatever you start, you finish.
That's
You're not giving up. If you started it, and if he paid for it, you're going to finish it, okay? If I want to start anything, a sport, a play, a writing something, anything, you started it, you need to finish.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, when you're involved in, like, change, trying to make change, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep going and say, okay, well, I know I want to make a change. I know that I have support. But it seems like every time I go 2 steps forward, I get 10 steps back. And change is not made. And it's like, what else can we do? It needs to be more than just 5 people or just me and a couple of my friends, me and a couple of my cousins. Like, it needs to be a whole group. The whole world has to want to change, not just a select few. It can't just be a couple of people.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to know what our listeners are going to do with our episodes that are coming out, and also with all the episodes that currently exist, just because I think Lauren's absolutely right. You know, it doesn't just take a few people. It takes a village. It takes a lot of people in order to make any sort of change. And also, I think we have to be really honest with ourselves. Conversation is not the end of it. You know, we're having a really good conversation right now, but if we walked out of the booth, it'd be like, okay, now right. What, right?
On to the next one.
And I think we learned a lot from the Ferguson uprising and protests and uprisings like that all the ways that change can happen. It could happen in the streets. It can happen when you're lobbying your members of Congress. It can happen in a town hall. It can happen even just by feeding people. Hands Up United was doing that, kind of riffing off of what the Black Panther Party has been doing, free breakfasts and books for kids. So I also think about what has changed my mind about things and helped me to understand race and class in America. Before the killing of Michael Brown, I went to this Sister Song conference, which is a conference about reproductive justice. And they were really focused on the case of Marissa Alexander, who experienced domestic violence. And at the same time, she was defending herself. And she had a child that she was also trying to defend. But for her, stand your ground laws didn't apply. Whereas we see that stand your ground laws do apply when you're someone who's killed someone, a child.
Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm. And I remember being part of a march that went along with that conference. And it was the first time I had ever encountered any movement for Black liberation. It was the Black Lives Matter march. And there were all these different images of people who've been killed by police, along with their names and their ages. And I think that if I hadn't gone to that conference and then immediately come back to St. Louis during the time that Michael Brown had been killed, I don't think I would have understood what was happening as much. So I really thank all the organizers and activists who've come before all of us who've been doing this work.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely thank them. And I just don't mean the Black activist. Everyone who has been involved in pushing equity forward for everyone, and not just in St. Louis, but nationwide. And so I really would like for our listeners to also understand that, like Josh said, storytelling and these conversations are not the end of it, but we must educate ourselves and those around us who may have a different point of view. You know, take them to the side and have a conversation with them, or pull up We Live Here on your phone and let them listen to an episode of, you know, real life stories from real people who experience some of this trauma. Because again, it's trauma. And so, yeah, we hope that it can be a resource for everyone who definitely listens.
And in some ways, I see this as a partnership with our listeners, because our job is really to kind of investigate, go deep with these stories, and really get to know people in the community who have the real experiences that reflect the policies. But it's up to our listeners to take this information, share it with a friend, share it with a neighbor, and also maybe use it in classrooms, maybe use it with people in power. That's up to you all. So what I'm excited about is the project of being able to take kind of the real facts and figures and so many stories. We have the work of an entire station behind us, in addition to what we'll collect together as a team. And I come from this having created a podcast of my own, Who Raised You podcast, with poet and educator Treasure Shields Redmond. And that podcast interviewed artists and change makers here in St. Louis in a way that asked them what motivates them, who raised them to do the work that they're doing now. And it was much more of a culture and arts podcast, in my opinion. And in this project with We Live Here, I think it leans more on education. I think it leans more on history. And it will also surface some of the policies and the stories that interact with each other. So I'm really excited about the important work that we're all doing together.
It makes me think, how did I get to this point right
yes.
now?
Mm.
How did I get to where I'm sitting here in this chair working for this station?
At an NPR member station.
NPR member station, okay? And just in general in life, all the sacrifices that older people in my family had to make.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they're still alive, mm-hmm. like my grandparents are still alive, and they went through this, and they can see all the changes that the world has been through,
mm-hmm.
but how it's still the same. It's just in a different form. And mm-hmm. people say history repeats itself. And I know, just talking to my grandparents and just knowing that they made this travel from down south all the way here, starting in St. Louis, then going to Chicago, and they had to endure a lot of things, but in their mind, my grandchildren and their children, they were able to go to college. They mm-hmm. were able to get jobs in fields that they wanted to do instead of just working factory jobs and jobs to make ends meet and jobs to take care of the family. But we have so many more opportunities, and to them, that's the most important thing. But also, I feel like before I go, or anybody that I feel like is my age leaves this place, that some change, I would like to see some change actually be made, that I can say I witnessed this, mm-hmm. that the world actually did change. I can tell you some stories about what happened in this time,
mm-hmm.
but the world actually did change.
Granny Lauren, did that really happen?
That's what they'll say, right?
But yeah, and they'll say, well, we listen to a story and we live here.
I think mm-hmm. that's powerful, though, to be able to write your own narrative, and that in some ways with this show, hopefully we'll be able to kind of co-write narratives with people in yep. these communities.
Yep, I would say all three of us are our ancestors' wildest dreams. I bet if we asked our grandparents and great-grandparents, could they have foreseen three women of color co-host and producing any show, radio, TV, that they would have probably said, no, you can't do that. They won't let you do that. What's wrong with you? This is what you're supposed to be doing. This is what, you know, the jobs that we have. But I would say that we have come a long way, and there's still work to be done.
Yeah, and Lauren, I really feel that, though, the kind of protectiveness of people who come before you, because I remember sometimes going to a protest and my mom be like, do you really have to do that? And she's super religious. She goes to like 4 Bible studies a week, and she used to be like, I'll pray to God about it. You don't have to do that. And then I'll be like, but you are also the same person who's told me stories about colonialism in Taiwan. Mm. And that, even though it's not about race and class in the same way, it's helped me to understand power structures in the world, and in some ways motivated me to become part of this work of moving things forward in a way that gives power to more people. We hope this episode helps you to understand all that we're bringing to this show. We just wanted to let you know what personal stake that we have in this show, in We Live Here. And we imagine that you have a stake in that too. So even though conversations won't solve racism, we do know that storytelling is a huge part of moving things forward. And we really look forward to creating awesome podcasts that dive deep into stories like these.
We Live Here is produced by me, Ashley Renee.
And me, Jalian.
I'm Lauren, associate producer.
Thank you, Lauren. The show is overseen by Tim Lloyd, senior producer of On Demand and content partnerships at St. Louis Public Radio.
And Robert Peterson, director of radio programming and operations.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is
We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.